Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, December 30th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Restorative Justice Overview, Part 1 of the Pieces the Way Retreat, led by Tim Hansen, session number HAT-2003-01. Let's listen in.
What occurred to me last night and this morning as I was thinking more about the session and reflecting on some of the comments and things that you all had to say last night was that realized that one adjustment I could probably make in my time with you all this retreat is that I don't have to sell this as much as I usually have to. In the prison system or in the correctional system, I usually have to spend a lot of time convincing people that our current way that we deal with crime is not working, that it's not a very functional sort of thing. But people who have invested their life and perhaps a lot of their money into a justice system, into the justice system as it's currently set up, are sometimes pretty resistant to thinking about a different way of dealing with conflict. So I'm going to try to pull back on that a little bit and realize that I perhaps don't have to do that as much, but still need to explain sort of the foundation and the philosophy and framework of restorative justice and how that differs from the current way that we think about and look at justice.
Has the Minnesota legislature, they decided that this is just a more cost-effective way? I've heard that the penal system is just imploding because it's just costing too much.
Yeah.
But, you know, have they decided this is cheaper?
No, I wouldn't say that there's been a recognition of that. And I would say that there hasn't even been a recognition that the current system is imploding, as you mentioned. But there is, I think, a recognition that restorative justice can be a more effective way of dealing with conflict, especially in regards to meeting the needs of victims, those that have been harmed. But our current system is so focused on offenders and the idea of punishing that offender that it's hard for people to shift over. And I pulled up some articles last week, and the prison population in the United States, anybody want to give a guess at what it is right now? How many people do you think we in prison?
We hit 2 million in the year 2000, yeah. What's it now?
Yep, that's the figure that I had was as of December of 2002, we were at 2,033,000. And it's only grown since then. We incarcerate more people in this country than any other country in the world. It's pretty mind-boggling, I think. And if we look at the expense, this is some of the selling point of it, but I think the information is still really interesting. In 2000, the Corrections Yearbook indicated that in the state of Georgia, it cost about $20,000 per inmate per year to incarcerate someone. Not a whole lot of programming goes on in Georgia, I can tell you. So in other states such as Minnesota, it's probably near $30,000 a year. I don't know what the tuition to Harvard or Yale is, but...
more than that.
Yeah. Is it? Some schools, at least.
That would be about St. Olaf.
Okay. I know Winona State wasn't near that. But so we look at the per year per inmate sort of cost, but then if we think about the prison industry, and it really is an industry, that the building of prisons, in Georgia they estimated that for each jail cell that was built, it cost about $60,000. $60,000 to build a jail cell, and then $20,000 a year to house somebody in that cell. And if you look at recidivism rates across the United States that range anywhere from 60% to 90%, I think it sort of spells out pretty well that what we're doing.
Can you define for me recidivism?
Someone getting out and recommitting a crime and ending up back in the system. Yeah, thanks for asking that. So the idea of rehabilitation or helping people to make better choices in their life, for the most part, doesn't work well in the current system that we've developed at this point. Before I get too much into that, I did want to start us off with a reading from Calling the Circle by Christina Baldwin, the first of future culture. And it speaks a little bit to community, and also I think speaks to how I hope we can be together in the next couple of days on the Peace of the Way tree as well. It's a writing by Starhawk in his writing, Dreaming the Dark. Community. Somewhere, there are people to whom we can speak with passion without having the words catch in our throats. Somewhere, a circle of hands will open to receive us, and eyes will light up as we enter. Voices will celebrate with us whenever we come into our own power. Community means strength that joins our strength to do the work that needs to be done. Arms to hold us when we falter. A circle of healing, a circle of friends, someplace where we can be free. I love that definition or that pondering on the concept of community. So I'm hoping that our time together will be a time when we can speak without the words catching in our throats, that we can ask questions and express ideas in a safe way in this space and time. So I'm going to I'm going to have us do a sort of an exercise together. But I'm thinking maybe before we do that, let me talk a little bit about our current justice system and kind of how we got to the place that we are. Again, this is sometimes one of the sort of selling points that I try to do with correctional professionals. Because sometimes we get into this mindset, well, this is the, I mean, we've always done it this way. You know, you hear that at Holden. But, you know, well, no, I mean, the jails, the prisons, the courts, the fights with the attorneys, the game, I mean, that's the way it's always been. There's no other way to do that. Well, that, of course, isn't reality. And throughout history and time, there's been a variety of different ways that we as community have dealt with wrongdoing or dealt with harm in our midst. I believe that if we go back long enough in any of our ancestral lines, that there was a time and a place when we gathered around in a circle, probably around a fire and probably around food, to make decisions and to deal with harm or to deal with conflict that happened. How do we deal with someone that stole something? How do we deal with someone who harmed somebody else? And I believe that as we gathered, probably in a circle, we listened to one another and we explored creatively some of the different options and ideas that might come up to deal with the harm that happened. And I believe that we listen very attentively to our elders for their wisdom and their life experience. So when we talk about restorative justice and sort of the philosophy of restorative justice, I want to be very clear that it isn't anything that Howard Zaire, Kay Prentice, or anybody else that you might read about invented. That really what we're talking about is ancient wisdom. We're talking about wisdom that some cultures have lost, some cultures have been able to hang on to a little better than others, and it's that wisdom that we're trying to sort of resurrect in a way and bring back and say there's great healing, there's great potential in this wisdom, and there's incredible chaos in the way that we've created a formal system at this point. But that's not to say that there aren't some good things about the system that we developed. I mean, there were some great hopes, and there still are some great hopes within that framework. And so when we talk about restorative justice, we're not talking about a revolution necessarily overthrowing the entire justice system as we currently have it. But we're talking about making some major changes and impacting the way some of it unravels when folks get caught up in it. So our current system, there seem to be several different times when shifts sort of happened for us as a community in the way that we dealt with harm. One of the major shifts happened in England in the 11th century with William the Conqueror, when he came over and conquered England. And it was at that time when this idea of the king's peace was established in the land. And what the king's peace meant that whenever there was not peace or some sort of disorder or a conflict, that it was really about the king. So if there was a conflict between the two of you, it really wasn't so much about the two of you, but me as the king somehow. So there develops sort of this huge shift that rather than communities taking care of conflict with one another, sometimes in good ways, sometimes not in such good ways, and the idea that a person who did harm and the person that was harmed, that that conflict was really owned by them and by the broader community that it affected, suddenly the king stepped in and said, no, that's disrupting my peace. So it's a violation against me. And so that shift, you can see how it rippled through society, and that's what we've based our current justice system on, is sort of that English model. So what happened back then, say if I was William, the king, and Ed and Shelley had a conflict, Shelley stole some fruit from Ed, I would bring them into my what? Into my court. Into the king's court to appear in front of me to explain, you know, what's going on here. And sometimes less to explain and more to say, Shelley, you won't do that again. That's wrong, you know. And I might ask you, Ed, so, you know, what happened? Well, she stole this. Okay, great. I'm done with you. So now, Shelley, we're going to punish you so that you don't do that again. And then eventually this idea came up, well, maybe you should pay a fine. Yeah, you should pay £5 to me because you're messing with the king's peace as opposed to the person that was harmed. See how that shift began to happen? And then it happens again. Shelley comes back again. Shelley, don't you get it? You're going to pay me £25. Is that enough punishment? And suddenly there's some income that starts to get generated over time, if you can sort of see the threads of that. And the idea that, well, you still keep doing it, well, I'm going to punish you harder and harder and harder, and eventually I'm just going to cut off your head. You know? I'm just going to be done with you. And so you see in our current system, you've got the judge who appears, and we come into the court. And for the most part, the victim's voice is only to say, well, what happened? Can you tell us what happened? And only the facts. Don't be giving us any emotion. Don't be talking about, oh, the pain and suffering that you had. No, what was the financial damage? What happened? Thank you. I'm done with you. Now let's turn towards the offender. And what do we need to do to her or to him to make sure that you don't do this again? How long do we have to lock you up? How much do we have to charge you or fine you? And, you know, do we need to execute you? So I'm simplifying it, of course, and I'm just kind of going fast forward to making those connections. But what I want us to be aware of is that there was a shift, and it was somewhat of an intentional shift in regards to the idea that if I do harm, that it's the state of Minnesota versus Tim Hansen, as opposed to the person that I harmed. And rather than my physically assaulting Janet and harming her in some sort of way, I broke state statute 78346. And in Minnesota, we even have sentencing guidelines so that we don't have to spend too much time in the court talking about all this stuff. Oh, he did this, he did this, he gets this. Off you go with that punishment. And so I think, you know, some of the craziness of the whole courts, and then we've kind of tried to streamline it to make it even more efficient and quicker, but it's just dehumanized it. And so that's sort of some of the negative reflection. Now, certainly there are positive pieces of it in that... back in the 11th century, if Shelley stole an apple from Ed and Ed decided that he needed to chop off Shelley's arm to make sure that she doesn't do it again, you might want to come in front of the king's court, you know, so that I can make perhaps a better or a less violent. And actually, that's where some of the eye for an eye conflict, the biblical concept of an eye for an eye came, that there was an attempt at that time to sort of try to equalize punishment in regards to offense. So if I stole one of your goats, it wouldn't be right for your family to come and demand three of my goats in return. Eye for an eye was meant to say, no, one goat for one goat is what makes sense. You know, so it was sort of an equaling sort of thing. But there was also the idea that a challenge that an eye for an eye isn't necessarily equal either, because my eye and what I see and what I experience is much different than your eye and what you've seen and what you experience. And so there's a question about even the equalness of that. So that's just a kind of a brief history in regards to how we've got to where we are. I would say that in the last 20 years or so, the victims' rights movement has done a lot to impact our court system. The victim's voice is heard more. There are a chance for victim impact statements to be made in courts, for people to talk more openly about the impact beyond the financial impact of the harm. But it varies from court to court. I've met with some judges who say, I can't have some victim screaming and crying in my courtroom, because that affects the justice that's going to happen. The jury might be swayed in some sort of way. So we can't have that. And I've talked to other judges who say, yes, I have the victim come in, and secondary victims, anyone else who's been impacted, I let them speak for as long as they need to speak. So it varies from courtroom to courtroom. But there's this hope, this idea, you know, the statue of the Greek woman with the scales, the scale of justice, and she wears a blindfold, right? Because justice is supposed to be blind or supposed to be all equal. But we know that's not true either with the number of, especially African-American men that we incarcerate in the United States. The disproportionate numbers of confinement within corrections is mind-boggling, absolutely mind-boggling. And it's not that African-American men or Hispanic women or other minority groups commit more crimes. It's just that either they don't have the money to buy themselves out of the system or to hire the appropriate attorneys, or they're racially profiled from the beginning. So that could be a whole other retreat time that we could sort of look at the discrimination that happens in the midst of that. So that's all to say that there's a lot that's not working very well in our court systems, and many of us believe that the concepts of restorative justice is a ray of hope and a ray of possibility. It's again a resurrecting of some of the ancient wisdom in ways that we feel can be very powerful and impactful in meeting the needs of victims, people who have been harmed, but also meeting the needs of offenders who have done that harm, and the needs of the broader community. How do we re-strengthen that community together? Any questions sort of or challenges about sort of that history and sort of how we've gotten to that point? Yeah, Danny.
I guess I want to challenge just a little bit, and I realize you were really simplifying in order to make the connection, but it does seem to me that when you talk about the state of Minnesota or the people and then taking that back to the king as the personification of the people, that's more than just a sense that the offense is against the state or this individual. But in the ideal, it embodies a sense of the common good. And that's when you got over here to why Ed can't cut her arm off, having the entity that represents the common good, the peace of the people, I think is fairly essential to a just system.
Yes.
I think in the victims' rights movement, there is a tendency to reinforce the individualism of our society. And as much as I'm sympathetic to it, I do think there is a part of it that is re-emphasizing it's all about individual injury. And so I just kind of want to raise that I'm hoping restorative justice isn't just that it's both end, the common good as well as individual protection.
Right. Excellent points. And I liked your wording in regards to in the ideal sense, that the idea of the state would be the common good, and that's true. Restorative justice differs somewhat from the sort of the victims' rights movement in that restorative justice says the community has to play as an important role as the victim as does the offender, where some of the movement for victims, because they've been so silenced and isolated from the justice system, are saying, it's about me, it's about me, it's all about me. And within a restorative justice framework, we recognize, no, it's about you primarily because the harm was towards you, but it's also about the common good. It's about how has this affected the rest of the community as well, and what obligation and what role do we all have in making things right again?
Well, and that's what I was hoping to hear a little bit, I think, because because I was the one who stole the apple, all of a sudden my brain went off on,
you realize
yeah, but I have kids at home who need to be fed, and their dad died, and we have no income because we're poor peasant folk, and he's got this whole orchard, and he doesn't share, and we're hungry, and, you know, don't take off my arms because then my little ones have no food.
Yeah.
And so a king might be able to, you know, help me out here, and yes, sorry, Ed, I took your apple, but starving children or take his apple. Easy choice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so does restorative justice have some room for that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, it's elevating that role of the victim, of the offender, and of the community. And we'll talk about some of the principles that sort of underlie that and all. And right, there might be a situation where King might have been open to hearing more of that. But as time got shorter and we needed to sort of move the process along, and our current court systems where juvenile cases take about an average of 7 minutes as they run it through in front of the judge. So we don't have time to be hearing all of that information. You know, let's just cut to the facts and be done with it. Okay.
You've talked about systems evolving. And in a sense, the king was an evolution from community.
Mm-hmm.
If Shelley took my apple here in this community, the whole community would know it almost immediately,
yeah.
And the whole community would be in judgment. Or, you know, what is the solution? How do we resolve this problem? Look at our society today. You're anonymous outside of a very small group of people. You can be out there doing what you want to, and society doesn't know it. So the king filled that role, as does our court system, of saying, we've got to bring this back into a framework and try to resolve it somewhat equitably.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I think we failed in that system in that we got it to be so complicated that suddenly Ed and Shelley could no longer speak for themselves. We needed to have attorneys to come in and suddenly study this and learn this and speak for you.
We failed in a sense that we have made it so much more complex, but that complexity has been also a result of the growth, the numbers of people involved.
The
community has expanded to billions of people.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep, I definitely agree. I mean, I think we can trace back some of the positiveness of it, and I think we can see where it got off more and more and more, and the complication of it, and suddenly the professionalism of it, and you know, suddenly people that I talk to that get involved in the system, either as victims and offenders, most of the time really don't have much of an idea of what is happening. And what they're told is, you don't talk to anybody. I've talked to offenders that just yearned to offer some sort of apology or explanation to the victims. Absolutely, you do not talk, you do not discuss this. You know, I'm your attorney, it's now mine, and it's about me winning. You know, that sometimes the guilt and the innocence isn't so much a part of it as, you know, I'm gonna win this case for you, I'm gonna get you off with less. I've had offenders tell me I wanted to plead guilty to it all. I wanted to accept responsibility. They wouldn't let me,
yeah.
Sort of idea. We had a case a couple months ago in Minnesota, a young man who pled to second degree manslaughter, which puts him with life in prison. And that was totally against all of his advising from all of his attorneys. They were all going nuts. And this kid, 17-year-old, said, no, I did it. And I want to admit that I did it and take responsibility for it. And so the judge heard his plea and let him speak. And what a sense of peace that was, really, for the survivors of the young man, a store clerk that he had killed. But it was, you know, a big article, because suddenly, what did this kid do? Is he crazy? You know, he admitted to what he did and took responsibility. This is nuts. What's happening? So that would be such a shock to the system that we've created, as opposed to, yeah, it's about honesty and it's about accountability and responsibility with one another. So. Well, what I'd like to have us do is to do just a short exercise. And it means that you have to put down your knitting. I'm sorry about that. But you'll each need a piece of paper and a pen or a pencil. And I can just ask you to pass those around. And I'm going to lay out a scenario to you and encourage you to do some writing. Anybody else need pen, pencil? Yes, it'll be an open book quiz. And as I resist the punishment and reward systems that we've set up, there won't be any grading. This is no right or wrongs. And I'd like to sort of present just a scenario to you and invite you to do a little bit of writing about it. And again, nobody else is going to see this besides yourself, although you're going to be sharing some of the things together in a little bit. What I'd like you to think about is if you can put yourself sort of in this scenario where you have a number of siblings and your parents have both recently died. And there has been some conflict and tension and disputing around what to do with the family business. Your parents owned a business that has been in the community for a long time. And now that they're both gone, you and your siblings can't come to an agreement in regards to what needs to happen to that business. One needs to sell it. We need to sell it right now. I need my piece of the money. I got some stuff I need to get done. Others are saying, no. We have a commitment to the community. Our folks have had this store forever. We've got to keep it going on. It's kind of going back and forth. And there's been various conversations and tensions with one another. And it's finally erupted to the point where we said, fine, we're going to court on this. We can't figure it out. We're going to go to court and we're going to see who gets this. So that's sort of where the tension in the family has sort of elevated to. Well, everyone has agreed that we will try to come together one last time. This is our final time as siblings, as family, to come together to try to make a decision in regards to what to do with this family business. So what I'd like you to reflect on is you are driving away from that day, that afternoon that you've spent with your siblings, making this decision about what to do with the family business. Okay? So you're driving away from that encounter. And what I'd like for you to briefly write out is, looking back at that, what are the qualities, or how is it that you would have hoped you were present with your siblings? How were you in your interactions? How were you in the conversation? How were you able to be in that space? Okay? So it's not about the decision. I've had people, when I do this exercise, sometimes people say, well, with my siblings, and it's not about the decision. It's about how did you want to see yourself in that experience? What qualities were you able to live out? Okay, so just reflect on that. Any questions about it? Diane's looking a little,
One of the things you didn't state in the beginning that would make a huge difference to me,
okay,
is whether the will of the parents left this with equal voice to the siblings or not.
Or was there a will?
Let's say that there wasn't a will.
Does
that make any? Yeah. And again, those are sort of some of the details of it. But it's more about knowing that this was the last chance. You've got to come together. You've got to try to work this out. What qualities did you want to bring to that?
And we're supposed to imagine our own very own siblings.
Not necessarily. But that's usually where most people go. But again, it's mostly about you. So I'm going to give you about 2 minutes to do this, and then then we'll go to the next step. You need 3 minutes. I'm going too quick. Okay. I'll watch and see how you're doing on this.
Imagine somebody else. Sorry.
The next step, what we're going to do is I'm going to ask you to just pair up with one person in the room. It could be someone next to you, or you want to meet somebody new that you haven't met, that's fine too. And what I'd like to challenge you to do is to, between the two of you, come up with a single list of the qualities that you've written down. Again, there aren't any right or wrong answers in this. But in your conversation, you may decide one fits, one doesn't, or these are basically the same, that sort of thing. But between the two of you, I'd like for you to combine your list into a single list with consensus on everything that's listed on there. And the sense of consensus, of course, is that you can live with whatever's there. You may not agree with it 100%, but yeah, I can live with that being on there. Okay? So I'm going to give you a couple of minutes to do that.
Right.
And you don't do a project too big.
What I wanted to have us do after this is to combine two groups. So there'd be four of you, or in this case, we could almost probably just do two groups, and I want you to have the experience of the larger group coming to consensus on your list. Okay? So I know there were three or four over here, but maybe you all could all be together, and maybe you all could be together to just come to consensus on your list. I know you may not have got all the way through with the two, but... Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, you did?
Could be.
Okay, let's pull back together as a single group. Is there someone that might be willing to come and sit here and jot these down as we combine one list together? Would you?
That's why.
Oh, she has temptation.
I know that it's challenging when we do this exercise sometimes to try to not necessarily go with what I would do in my family or to sort of move that way. But what we're looking for again is how you would have wanted to be, and again. And really what we're trying to clarify for ourselves is a list of values. Values that are important to us in how we act in especially conflict situations, because the situation that I sort of set you up in was a decision making, but it was also conflict. It was very charged because it was having to do with family and relationships and a variety of different things potentially. So let's just hear from each group. Give us one off of each of your lists until we make sure that we've got them all combined. And Janet will write them down for us. Yeah. So who sort of...
We said calmness.
Calmness. And the goal behind calmness, or how do you define that?
Just stay cool.
To stay cool.
In an atmosphere in which listening can occur.
Okay. Yeah, but listening, it sounds like.
That was the second one on our list.
Was that the second one? All right. I question that, just the calmness, like sometimes there's cultural implications to that sense of calmness, because in some families or in some ethnic groups, cultural groups, what is calm to one person is not even close to what's calm for another person, so there's got to be some sense. But I like that idea of staying cool. I mean, you're not talking about escalating things, but raised voice might be fine for one person in a situation where for another person, anything above a whisper in an intense situation could really be disarming. So just to be sensitive to that. Well, who kept your list?
I did. In terms of calm, we put patience. But then I'll give you our. I think we want to add that. Should we add that to that? Okay. Mm-hmm. And then our first one was two-way communication, being open, honest, and listening with your heart and hearing all positions, and then on the other hand, being true to yourself.
You put that all into one.
This was part of our consolidation process.
Okay. Two-way communication. I heard open. Mm-hmm.
Honest. Listening to your heart. Because almost everybody in our group had something that fell within that category.
And to differentiate between listening with your heart as opposed to listening with your head?
Yes.
Would be?
And hearing all positions. Oh, and then being true to yourself.
Listening with your just head honest. Might be listening for the angles. In a kind of strategic, maybe even borderline manipulative way.
Hidden agendas
and rational, cold attorneys in suits.
Okay.
We didn't say that. I'm just In my brain, yep. that's what that
yep.
came up with.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where listening with the heart is listening for the relationship issues.
Okay.
Loving.
Loving.
Which I would define along those same lines, being attentive to the relationship.
Okay, so
I'm speaking out of turn. I'm not as a representative of our group, but I think that's where we were coming from.
Okay.
The conversation was going.
Well, highlighting that the importance of relationship needs to be kept in mind. Okay, another one from over here.
Well, we had creative thinking outside the box and striving for a win-win situation.
Okay. Okay, another one from you all.
Well, this is out of order, but since they just said that, we said brainstorming, looking for plausible solutions slash compromises. So,
slash
compromises.
What?
Compromises. See, it's a hard word to come to play today.
Compromise is sometimes a buzzword
yeah.
for
yeah.
some people that yeah. is not one that fits. And sometimes the word consensus sort of gets confused with that word. Compromiser, kind of gets compared to it. Anyone want to touch upon what your meaning of compromise was? Whose list did that come from?
Several.
Okay.
Seems like.
I don't think we discussed compromise.
We
okay.
didn't discuss the word.
Okay.
Yeah.
okay.
I think the sense was so that, again, going back to that relational piece, so that whatever the decision is, it's been thoroughly looked at just to make sure it's as positive a decision as it can be for everybody. That was kind of my sense.
So be flexible with it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Did I get everything?
Yep, I think so.
And then our last one was committed to the spirit of the parents' wishes and committed to the broader community.
Okay. Keeping in mind all of the parents' wishes and the broader impact on the community.
And maybe those are two separate, but we decided to combine
yeah.
them.
okay.
I can't see what's right. What is it? Oh, hearing oppositions, because I think a word that we had was assertive. Along the lines of what is courageous.
Yeah, assertive and courageous, but attentive to the needs of others.
Okay. So,
assertive and what?
Courageous. I like that word. to be courageous. And we have honesty, too, that really connects with that as well.
Should I put
honesty
there?
Here? Well, we have it.
Oh, can I do it again?
And then we had a couple more along the lines of the loving, the honesty, all that was fairness and understanding.
Okay, fairness.
I guess with that, I'd like to throw in balance too, because there's sometimes that, you know, equal share is fair for everybody. Doesn't fit where the greatest needs might be. And,
okay.
And so that's kind of where...
Are you hearing fairness as a balance?
Well, or I'd like to add balance, maybe. Thinking of my specific family right now, and if we were to split things three ways, we wouldn't necessarily cover the greatest needs in the family.
So that may not be
and
fair.
So... Right. Well, I guess I think of fair as the three-way split.
Oh.
And I need to balance fairness with needs. Because in my family, if somebody got a half a scoop more ice cream, it wasn't fair. Uh-huh. And so yeah, definition of the word fair. You're right. Okay. Does fair include balance, or does fair eliminate the need for holding paradoxes?
Right.
There?
Right. So we'll add the word balance to kind of flesh it out.
We have two more on our list.
Okay. Y'all were busy.
Humor.
Humor. Humor. Great. Humor. I always love to see that
one.
Actually,
we have three more.
She's a bastard.
Yeah, I guess so.
although one of them is kind of up there, I was trying to read it as I was talking. Our third one was preserving relationships, but the attention to relationships is up there already.
Yeah.
And then finally, encouraging and affirming emotional expression and honesty.
Okay.
And that might come with listening with the heart.
Yeah.
But encouraging the expression in others was important, so that.
Oh, I'll keep it on one page. Yeah.
Okay.
And I think your group was also the one that said calm.
Mm-hmm.
So does that conflict with that in some sort of way?
I think the sense of calm is not just sit there and be quiet. It's maintaining us perhaps a sense of perspective, and within the emotional outbursts, the emotional whatever is going to happen, kind of maintaining your own centeredness so that that there isn't a lashing out or a go ahead.
Well, that you can be calm about the fact that you're emotional, that you have fear, that you have anger, and that once that's expressed and allowed to be expressed, not bottled up, you in fact do become a whole lot calmer.
Okay.
I think what you added earlier about not escalating things.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm hearing in there too, there's something about safety, that somehow it's going to be safe to do that, and that the group is going to be safe from violent expression or...
Good way to put it. Yeah.
Okay.
That's a good one. One of the suggestions that I made, but I don't know that it's a consensus, is that if this is a last-ditch stand before going to court, I would hope we might have a third party present to help create that safe atmosphere.
Yeah.
So the possibility of a third party. Mm-hmm. Well, in no time, I won't stretch this up much longer, but usually we'd sort of go back and talk about some of these, make sure that these are all fine with everybody. And but this list that we've come up with, maybe not exactly, but pretty much, this exercise has been done literally across the world in all different sorts of settings, different cultures, different economic spheres and everything else. And the amazing thing is that the list is basically the same. Is that we as humans basically come up with some of the same stuff that we say are really our core values, are the ways that we want to be with one another. Kate Prentice was challenged once and said, you go into a maximum security prison and there's no way that those inmates would come up with this list. So she did exactly that, and she came back with basically the same list. Because what we're talking about is what is our ideal self? What is the best that we could be in a situation where we've got a lot invested? And when it comes to that, we do go back to those core values of listening to one another, being safe, being loving, having a sense of humor in the midst of it. I was challenged that at a juvenile facility that I worked with, I did this exercise with the teaching staff and some of the caseworkers and some of the guards, and was a challenge, but we finally got through to this list, and I said that I was going to be doing the same exercise with some of the juveniles, and they said, absolutely no. I mean, they won't be able to do that. Kids these days don't adhere to these values. They don't understand that. I mean, that's the problem. All that is lost. And I tweaked the exercise a little bit and talked about Grandpa's car. Grandpa is going to give his car, and you and your siblings are trying to figure out what to do with Grandpa's car, and your youngest sibling is there watching. And how would you want that younger brother or sister to say you acted in the midst of this conversation? And they came up with pretty much the same list again. So it's pretty amazing that the sense of how we want to be together is pretty consistent. Sort of the words that often gets summarized in the midst of this, in a list that Kay has collected from all of the times she's done this exercise in her book. She's listed the values of love.